Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the reports of sabotage of Saudi and Emirati oil tankers in the Gulf, which, while they might be false flag operations, could also be the pretext that John Bolton and Secretary of State Pompeo are looking for to start a war with Iran. Clearly, Bolton is trying to goad the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps into triggering a small war, which could be blamed on Iran. And while Trump may not want a war at the moment, he might benefit from one closer to the 2020 elections. Paul Piller, a senior fellow at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, who was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia at the CIA, joins us to discuss his article at Loeb Blog, Bolton's War, and assess the risks involved in provoking a small, limited war with Iran in a volatile region that supplies 35% of the world's oil. We'll examine the differences between Trump's, Bolton's, and Pompeo's foreign policies, and the extent to which a wag-the-dog scenario is underway with Israel and Saudi Arabia urging the U.S., as former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates once observed, to, quote, fight the Iranians to the last American. With any military activity in the Gulf likely to cause a precipitous rise in the price of oil, we will look into who would benefit. With Iran under an oil embargo, in a limited war scenario, they would make more money for their oil on the black market. But if the Gulf were to be shut down by a wider conflagration, then Russia would be a big winner. Then we'll discuss Trump's latest dalliance with a despot at the White House today as he greeted the previously shunned Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban. Joining us is Kim Lane Shepley, a professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, who has an article at Foreign Affairs, Viktor Orban Wants Trump's Help in the European Elections, America First Meets Hungary First. We'll examine today's photo op that will greatly benefit Hungary's practitioner of soft fascism, who is the poster boy for Steve Bannon's efforts underway to get far-right parties in Europe elected in the upcoming EU elections in sufficient numbers to paralyze the European Parliament so they won't cut the subsidies to Hungary, which Orban depends on to maintain his kleptocratic hold on power. Then finally, with the stock market tanking on fears of a trade war with China, we will speak with William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker as well as a New York Times bestselling author. He joins us to discuss the dangers of having a financial fraudster like Trump, who is one of Wall Street's biggest losers, running the economy. We'll also examine his article at the New York Times, When Lenders Push Borrowers Over the Edge, which reveals a perverse incentive for hedge funds to use credit default swaps as a way to drive companies into bankruptcy in order to reap rewards, which is the opposite of why investors traditionally lend money wanting companies to succeed. And joining us now, Dr. Paul Piller, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the United States intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy, Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process, and Why America Misunderstands the World. And he has an article at Loeb Blog, Bolton's War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Paul Piller.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And when you talk about Bolton's war, it does seem that the U.S. and Iran's on a collision course. And, of course, Saudi Arabia and Israel are kind of the cheering us on. And I don't know the extent to which they want the Saudi leader and the Israeli leader want American boys and girls to fight their war for them. But what's your sense of how close we are? Because the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, have been targeted by U.S. sanctions. They are capable of doing some pretty crazy things with all those speedboats running around in the Straits of Hormuz. It seems to me to be a very incendiary situation. How does this latest story of these tankers being damaged in sabotage attacks play into that scenario?
Well, the sabotage of the tankers is one of the very types of incidents that could easily spin out of control, especially when you have a desire on the part of certain parties, the ones you just mentioned, to have it spin out of control. Now, it's very early in this particular story, and we simply don't know, you know, how much there is to work with if one does want to spin it into something. But certainly the first thoughts that would go through the minds of people in the White House and those other parties you mentioned, when you have something that caused damage to a couple of Saudi oil tankers and an Emirati oil tanker, is, ooh, was this Iran or its proxies that could be blamed for this or may actually have been involved? You know, right now we simply don't know. It's all a matter of speculation, but it is one but not the only type of incident that could easily escalate into something much bigger.
But is a limited war possible in that region, particularly with Iran, with those 12-mile-wide straits of Hormuz, which wouldn't take very much to sink a few tankers, and all of the oil coming out of the Gulf would be stopped, and of course the price of oil would go through the roof. So there's obviously a lot at stake. So how, I'm trying to figure out what Bolton and Pompeo have in mind as they push the envelope, what could you possibly achieve in a limited scope without a full-scale war against Iran, which is not a cakewalk?
Well, it's an excellent question what you can achieve, and I'm certainly not going to defend the reasoning of the likes of Pompeo and Bolton. I think it's badly mistaken. But what I think they have in mind is something they would certainly consider limited. I don't think they have anything in mind like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which is to say a full-scale ground war and directly through military force overthrowing the regime. I mean, I think even they realize Iran would be a far, far bigger and more difficult enterprise just to get that far. I think they're thinking in terms of airstrikes, which would inflict damage on some of the military and nuclear capability of Iran, and they hope stir up enough just instability inside Iran that they would get closer to their goal of regime change. You are quite right about the secondary and tertiary economic effects, particularly through the direct impact on the oil trade when you have hostilities in the Persian Gulf. It was noted in some of the reporting with regard to this tanker sabotage that it's something like 20% of the world's oil consumption goes through the Strait of Hormuz, this very place we're talking about. So if that gets disrupted, yes, the economic effects would be not of a scale that we would like to call limited, but I think the likes of Bolton and Pompeo are still not talking about all-out war.
Well, they appear to be trying to goad the Iranians into creating causes belli, a pretext for war.
That's right. I mean, whatever they do, they want to make sure that the blame can be placed somehow on the Iranians, and there are several facets to this. Despite the Iranian patience, which has basically lasted for a year since the Trump administration reneged on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. But now, finally, their patience has been running out to the point where they the Iranians, are talking about taking some steps that do exceed the agreed limits and restrictions in the JCPOA. Possibly they may do other things that could be pointed to by the U.S. administration as misbehavior on the part of Iran that would justify striking them.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Pillar, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. And he's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy, Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process, and Why America Misunderstands the World. And he has an article at Loblog, Bolton's War. But the thing that seems to be so counterintuitive about what Bolton and Pompeo are up to is that if you want to separate the government of Iran, which nobody likes, from the people, the last thing you want to do is attack Iran, because the people will rally around the flag. And from my understanding is they are supporting President Rouhani's call that these draconian sanctions are in effect an attack on Iran by the United States. So we shouldn't be in a position of distracting from the terrible misrule of the Ayatollahs, surely.
Well, you're right to raise the issue of how what the U.S. does may affect how the Iranian public apportions the blame for whatever economic hardship or other aspects of their living situation they feel unhappy about. Iran has severe economic problems right now, and they have multiple causes. You know, the sanctions have a lot to do with it, but also there's a lot of mismanagement endemic to the Iranian system, which does involve the Revolutionary Guard, by the way, which has a very large economic role. So it's a mixture of things. And I think most ordinary Iranians realize it's not all one thing or all another. And so I think it is true that to the extent that the sanctions and the accompanied by the unrelenting open hostility of the U.S. administration has had an effect on Iranian public minds that is in the direction of attributing more of the blame for their situation on us and less on their rulers. And I would add to this that the administration hasn't helped the matter by things like the travel ban, which of course was one of the more prominent issues we were all talking about a year or so ago. But you know, that was aimed at well, a number of Muslim populations, but the one that was affected the most in terms of just the sheer number of people who had family travel plans curtailed and that sort of thing were the Iranians.
So if anything were to spark a wider conflagration, my understanding is that Iran would strike immediately at Saudi Arabia. I don't know whether they strike at the U.S. fleet and the aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, apparently it's on its way to the Gulf, and I'm not sure whether it would actually go into the Gulf, which is a fairly narrow waterway for a big carrier. I'm not sure exactly where they'd place that, perhaps on the other side, on this, in the Indian Ocean. But nevertheless, my understanding is the Iranians have dug in bunkers along the coast opposite Saudi Arabia with missiles that would be fired at Abqaiq and all of the big oil facilities. Is that your understanding?
Well, I don't know that we can game out in detail just what operationally and tactically the Iranians would do. I mean, you're getting to one of their options, and the Iranian leaders have, including Revolutionary Guard leaders, have spoken specifically about how if Iranian oil exports were to really go down to zero, either through sanctions alone or as a combination of sanctions and military force, that they would not want to see other exporters, the ones across the Gulf, their competition, let their oil trade continue uninhibited. So I think it is among the numerous options that would be available to the Iranians for striking back in some way at the United States or at what are considered U.S. allies. Certainly the oil exports of the Saudis and the Emiratis would be fairly high on the list.
But there's something short of that that the Iranians might do, since they are under an oil blockade, but they are still getting their oil on the black market, particularly through Iraq. So they would benefit from a rise in the price of oil. So how much do you think that might be a calculus on the Iranian side to cause mischief in order to scare the market and raise the price of oil?
Well, there are mixed motives here. I mean, the curtailment of Iranian oil exports so far has been a matter solely of sanctions and U.S. pressure with secondary sanctions and not a matter of, you know, U.S. military force. But if we are talking about a scenario in which the blades have been unsheathed and U.S. Military force is in use, then I think part of the Iranian calculation has to be whether you know, their exports really would go to zero, and not just because of sanctions but because of a military operation. So that they would have to figure that into their calculations, and if the price of oil goes up but their exports are zero, that obviously doesn't help them. I think most of the important Iranian decisions along these lines have not yet been made, and they would be preparing options and preserving their options, and then when the situation arose, then they would make their decisions as to exactly how they'd respond.
Well, President Trump does not want the price of oil to go up, particularly as we get closer to the election. So how does that factor in? There does seem to sometimes contradictions from Trump to what Bolton is saying, particularly about Venezuela and to some extent Pompeo. It does sound like we have maybe three foreign policies at work here.
Well, this is one of the ways in which some of the objectives of the current administration tend to conflict with each other. Yeah, you're right. The president does not want the price of oil to go up and to have that reflected at the pump for American consumers. But I think at least as much to the point in this situation, I don't think President Trump wants a war with Iran. I think when we talk about U.S. objectives, we have to be very specific about which U.S. official we're talking about. There's no doubt that John Bolton would welcome a military clash. I mean, he's on record as saying some time ago, we should have bombed Iran. That does not seem to be Donald Trump's desire. And some of the hope that some of us who look at this situation with some alarm, for the reasons we were discussing a few minutes ago about how easily it could all spin out of control, have at least in the backs of our minds the hope that Donald Trump himself is going to see the disadvantage for his own presidency and his own political prospects and terminate the services of Mr. Bolton. I don't know if that's going to happen, but there have been some reports that the president has expressed some unhappiness and disgruntlement with other things that John Bolton has done in connection with North Korea and what have you. So we'll see if the president gets this message. I hope he does.
Well, apparently, you point this out in the article at Loeb Log, Paul Pillar, that titled Bolton's War, that one of the reasons that Trump didn't hire him out, you know, he obviously started out with General McMaster, was because he didn't like Bolton's mustache. But apparently, it was the biggest donor to his campaign, Adelson, the casino owner, that persuaded him to take on Bolton. So, and Bolton takes money from the MEC, the Iranian opposition, a pretty unsavory group. And also, Rudy Giuliani takes money from the MEC. So you got a couple of compromised high-level officials in there that, to some extent, have Trump's ear.
Yes, and at least so far as we know, Trump isn't taking money from the MEK. We're talking about this rather loathsome terrorist group called the Mujahideen Ikhalq that has been latched onto by some people over here, some of whom, like the ones we just mentioned, Giuliani and Bolton, who have been on their payroll for getting five-figure fees for delivering speeches on behalf of the MEK. But Trump did, you know, make his peace with Sheldon Adelson back partway through the presidential campaign. I think you're quite right to raise Adelson's name as probably the decisive factor that got John Bolton his job, because the motivations we're looking at here are basically the ones of the Netanyahu government, because that's what Adelson is most interested in supporting, and everything having to do with Iran, thus for Adelson, and hence indirectly for Bolton, are all related to what are the preferences of the current right-wing Israeli government.
So we get back to wag the dog, right? The tail that wags the dog, whether it's Netanyahu or Mohammed bin Salman.
There is a large element of that, and certainly, you know, Netanyahu has his internal problems with the corruption issue. Mohammed bin Salman has lots of his image problems and the war in Yemen and other difficulties to deal with. So, for each of those people, there is a wag the dog element. I think what we have to hope will not happen is that there will be a similar wag the dog type reasoning that gets into the mind of Donald Trump. If say the U.S. economy hits a recession, and his political prospects get to be dimmer and dimmer as next year's election approaches, we unfortunately cannot rule that out. And in fact, we can. There's even evidence already that that sort of thinking has entered Trump's mind, because back when he was just a candidate, he had thrown around some accusations that's something that Barack Obama might do, you know, start a war to distract attention from his political challenges. So it's not as if this is something that Trump has never thought of.
Well, Dr. Paul Pilar, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Pilar, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the United States intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. And he's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy, Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process, and Why America Misunderstands the World. And he has an article at Low Blog, Bolton's War. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's latest dalliance with a despot at the White House today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them, Bobo Nyan, yeah. War is not the answer. I want to know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. We tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I want to know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
For a sign, I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware, the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Come see, remember me.
All my moving love, you said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is the Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kim Lade Shepley, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. She lived in Budapest from 1994 to 1998, doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary, and has taught both at the University of Budapest and at Central European University, where she was a founding director of the program in gender and culture. After 1989, Shepley studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. And she has an article at Foreign Affairs, Viktor Orban Wants Trump's Help in the European Elections, America First Meets Hungary First. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Lane Shepley.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And what's the explanation for why Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, who has been shunned by previous administrations, George W. Bush and Obama, has now been rewarded with a White House photo op today and a visit with President Trump. At the photo op, Trump says, "I know he's a tough man, but he's a respected man, probably like me, a little bit controversial, but that's okay. That's okay." And Orban, of course, said, "We are proud to stand together with the United States on fighting against illegal immigration, on terrorism, and to protect and help the Christian communities around the world." So that's what the two leaders said in terms of what the takeaway was. So is this just another example of Trump's peculiar affection for despots, given, of course, his romance with Sisi, with Philippines, Duterte, with Turkey's Erdogan, and President Xi of China, and of course, more gushing romance is with Kim Jong-un, probably the most violent and disgusting world leader there is, who Trump is pursuing a friendship with. So let me ask, I'm sorry to go on here, but so tell me, Kim, what is going on? Is this another dalliance with a despot, or is there some substance to this meeting? Because it certainly doesn't send the right signals.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that this is Trump's dancing with dictators, something he seems to like to do. So the fact that, somebody is an autocrat at home has never put Trump off welcoming them in Washington or giving them a kind of official platform with him. But in this case, there's actually also a subtext that's likely to be invisible to Americans, but that is really important for Trump's brand around the world, which we know he cares about, as well as for Orban's immediate future. And that is, in just a couple of weeks, there are elections to the European Parliament. And Orban is shaping up with Mr. Salvini of Italy and Marine Le Pen of France and some others. They're shaping up to have a new European-wide political party based on opposition to immigration and based on, you know, really sort of far-right values. And it's looking from the polls now like that party will be certainly the fourth largest, maybe the third largest, and maybe even the second largest parliament in the European Parliament. And in order to get that kind of victory continent-wide, Orban wanted to appear with Trump as a kind of dog whistle to the far right of Europe that he's been endorsed by Mr. Trump. Now, it turns out behind this political party is a familiar hand, and that is the hand of Steve Bannon, who orchestrated Trump's victory in the U.S. And the same team that worked on Trump's victory in the U.S. has been building the groundwork now for 2 years leading up to this European election to try to bring the same forces into power in the EU. So today's appearance with Trump was a kind of dog whistle to all those forces across the EU that, in fact, this is a global effort and that behind it is a set of common interests. So this was really significant in Europe, even if it was only a little bit of a blip on the American map.
So my understanding of what Bannon is trying to do is to get these far-right parties enough seats in the European Parliament to have a one-third of the seats, which then gives them veto power, and they could essentially paralyze the EU. I mean, what is his strategy? That's my understanding, and I don't know how much this is going to benefit Vladimir Putin, but it doesn't sound like a positive strategy. What does Bannon have in mind? Do you know?
Yes, well, I think that, you know, certainly you've heard it from Trump, right, where they've demoted the ambassador to the EU to, you know, less than a state level, that basically the EU is an irritant both to the U.S. and, frankly, to Russia as well, because it combines the force of 28 or perhaps 27 after Brexit countries into a single bloc that gives them a lot more power on the world stage than they would otherwise have. And if you're competing to be a big voice on the world stage, or if you want unquestioned dominance on the world stage, then what you want to do is to weaken and disrupt the EU. And one of the most effective ways to do that is to support the forces that are skeptical of the EU from within. So Viktor Orban has been one of the leading Eurosceptical voices. You know, he's repeatedly said, particularly on the question of immigration, which is sort of his signature issue, that the EU has failed, that the EU, you know, in 2015, when there was that huge wave of migration, that Hungary was the only one defending the external borders, and that the EU operation in Brussels simply failed to cope with the crisis. And so the solution here is more sovereignty, returning more power to the individual states that comprise the European Union. And in so doing, what that does is it weakens the power at the center of the European Union. So this is a long-run plan to disable Europe in the world and to create enough dissensus and sheer, you know, controversy within the EU that they can't agree on any policy mechanisms going forward. So it's a sabotage of the EU, and Orban's lead in it, and Bannon has been behind him. And these forces are perilously close to winning enough of a seat at the table that no one will be able to do anything without consulting them.
And again, I'm speaking with Kim Lane Shepley, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. She has lived in Budapest, where she's also taught at the University of Budapest and at Central European University. And she has an article at Foreign Affairs, Viktor Orban Wants Trump's Help in the European Elections, America First Meets Hungary First. And of course, the university that you taught at, Central European University, that was largely funded by George Soros, has had to move to Vienna. It was driven out of Hungary by Orban, who launched an attack on Soros, which had certainly smacked of anti-Semitism. And now, of course, right next door to Hungary, Austria is run by a bunch of neo-fascists as well. So describe the soft fascism of Orban. How does it compare to, say, is he really modeling his country on Putin? Because it does seem that way, that he has a ruling party and he has a group of oligarchs that he favors, that they buy up the media to control it on his behalf, etc. There seems to be a similarity there that's pretty stark.
Well, it's certainly the case that Orban is the closest European leader to Vladimir Putin, and that Orban has copied a lot of Putin's strategies, particularly with regard to the way the media have been constrained and confined. But Orban is also playing a game within the EU. So a lot of what Orban has been trying to do is to create a Hungary that looks tolerably enough like a European member state that the other member states won't, you know, try to, they can't throw it out, but they haven't really been able to sanction Hungary. So Orban wants to look less like Russia and more like another member state of the European Union. But he also plays on a lot of tropes that he knows he can get the Hungarian population to go along with. And anti-Semitism is an old story in Hungary. It's something that has been pretty dormant since 1989, but it's a resource that can always be called upon when, you know, fear and loathing become the order of the day, and that's what Orban has done. So the sort of dog whistle anti-Semitism and attacking George Soros is part of this. It's gone along with an advertising campaign in which there are all these pictures of Mr. Soros's face plastered all over every single flat surface in the country. And the picture they use is something that's reminiscent of all of these old, you know, sort of anti-Semitic posters from the 1930s. So Orban's clearly playing that card. And it's serious enough that a lot of Jews who live in Hungary, and Hungary was one of the few countries in Eastern Europe that actually had a Jewish population that survived the Holocaust. I mean, obviously, it was a minority of the Jews who had been in Hungary before, but still there's a pretty vibrant Jewish community. And many Jews living in Hungary are starting to say, is it safe to live here? So it's gotten very challenging, I would say, for anyone staying there. But, you know, Orban himself is probably not an anti-Semite. He's someone who opportunistically uses this rhetoric to, you know, to create certain animosities and to stir up tension and to be the bad boy, right, of Europe. So, yes, he's used all these kinds of dog whistles, and yes, his government is overtly, as Orban himself puts it, illiberal and Christian. But every once in a while, Orban does something. I mean, when he started this campaign against George Soros and the world started saying, you know, this is an anti-Semitic campaign, Viktor Orban called in his great ally, Mr. Netanyahu from Israel, who came to Hungary right before the election and said, Viktor Orban is my friend, and he's not an anti-Semite. We hate George Soros, too. Orban knows how to play this game so that none of it ever sticks to him in a permanent kind of way.
Well, one of the tricks that Orban plays in conjunction with the Polish right-wing leaders is they protect each other from veto power in terms of the EU, censuring them in any way. So why is it that the European Union that this guy, Orban, is trying to undermine with Steve Bannon's strategy of bringing all these right-wing parties up to the point where they'll be able to absolutely make the European Parliament completely dysfunctional? Right. And so, but at the same time, the EU gives him tons of money. So why do
yes, well, here's the irony of the EU. So the EU was designed with a lot of checks by the member states on what the EU can do, but not a lot of checks from the EU side on what member states can do. So, you know, Orban has basically built an autocracy where however he ever gets out of office, it will not be through the ballot box. And that's the worry, because people are starting to talk about, you know, revolution in the streets and things like that once they realize that elections no longer work. Orban's been followed by Mr. Kaczynski in Poland, who's been going very much down the same road. of whipping up this kind of right-wing nationalist fervor, but using the cover of that ideology to shut down the independence of courts, to go after civil society, to pressure the media, and on and on. It's the same kind of playbook. Now, the way the EU was designed, the most serious sanction that can be levied against a member state is that its voting rights and its funding are suspended. But in order to do that, so far, the thought has been that you have to invoke this one provision of the treaties that hold the EU together, and that's a provision that requires a unanimous vote of all the member states except the one to be sanctioned before these sanctions can issue. So once you've got two member states that are allied with each other, then either of those member states can veto any sanctions against the other member state. And so that has flummoxed the EU now ever since Poland became a fellow traveler. And so now the EU is actually looking to other methods for trying to discipline or punish or at least not be complicit in supporting these autocratic governments in the EU. So they've started to look at how to cut funds. And we're just about to have these European elections. There's a kind of five-year, there are elections every 5 years, and there's a policy cycle every 5 years, and there's a budget every 5 years. So there's about to be a new budget, and there's a regulation that's pending and may well pass, actually, that allows the European Commission, which is kind of the executive branch of the EU, to assess whether countries that are getting money from the EU are complying with rule of law norms. And if not, then the Commission will be given the power, if this regulation passes, to cut their funding. So that could be actually the tool that the EU is moving toward. And if that happens, then we'll see some very interesting developments, because Mr. Orban runs his country by taking in EU money, passing it through the state, and having it all exit into the pockets of his friends. And if he didn't have that money to pay off his top supporters, the question is whether they would still support him. So, you know, this runs the risk of being an existential threat to the way Orban has run his government if the EU can find the law and the voice to actually cut the funds to him. So that's very much in prospect. The EU moves slowly, and it does require legislation, which means you need what's called a qualified majority vote of all the other member states. And right now, well, depending on whether there's Brexit or not, it's either 22 or 23 other member states need to sign on to that. And I'm told by people at the Council of Ministers, which is where this would be voted on, that they think they may have the votes. So this could go through, and we could start seeing real funding cuts in the next budget cycle. The question then is, of course, if the results of these elections provide any occasion for the European institutions to feel like they can't any longer do it because it's too much of a popular sentiment, this kind of anti-EU, anti-Euro, you know, anti-EU and Euroskeptical view. I mean, if they're facing a wall of that, not just from Hungary, but lots of other parties in other member states, they may hesitate.
Well, there you have it. That ties into what happened today at the White House, that Donald Trump is helping Orban, who in turn is working with Bannon and all these right-wing parties across Europe, AfD in Germany, Le Pen in France, etc., Salvini in Italy, and if they could get enough members in there, they could stymie the EU's only mechanism to stop this guy who's taking their money and using it to, as you say, to hold on to power, to pay off his cronies. The whole thing is so sick and cynical, and it's such a shame that our president is a part of this scam.
Right. Well, I might say that, you know, our president has admired Orban. Orban has admired our president. But, you know, it's time for distinguishing our president from his administration, because actually the State Department and Mr. Pompeo and our foreign policy establishment and the leaders in Congress who work on foreign policy issues have all been trying to discipline Orban or punish him or at least call him out for all the ways in which he hasn't supported official U.S. policy. So what we're seeing today is our president siding with Orban over the policies of his own administration. And that raises some really interesting questions for what the U.S. itself does next.
Well, Kim Lane Shepley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Kim Lane Shepley, who's a professor of sociology and international affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. From 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at the Central European University, where she was a founding director of the program in gender and culture. And after 1989, Shepley studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. And she has an article at Foreign Affairs, Viktor Orban Wants Trump's Help in the European Elections, America First Meets Hungary First. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the stock markets tanking today on fears of a trade war with China.
Your dough was horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. And go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, apples shrilling in fear. And won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spear. Here, a new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Cohan, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker, as well as a New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column for the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, When Lenders Push Borrowers Over the Edge. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you for having me back, Ian.
Well, thanks, Bill. I'd like to talk about your op-ed, which is quite alarming. But just to touch on Wall Street taking a tumble today, lost about 700 points, about a third of the market. It's recovered, I think, to about 2% loss of the market, around 500. But still, it's clear that the market is very unsettled over this looming trade war with China. And frankly, I don't know from your perspective there on Wall Street, but it's pretty hard to have confidence in Trump's team, Larry Kudlow, the television guy. He's sort of like the financial equivalent of Rudy Giuliani. And the other character, this fringe academic Peter Navarro, is pretty bizarre on the trade. Lighthizer sounds like he's a pro. So what's your sense then of the Trump negotiating team, particularly when we learn, Bill, from the New York Times investigative report on Trump's taxes, that Trump himself is a total fraud as a businessman? He was the biggest loser, I think, in American capitalism there for a while, losing $1 billion. So I don't have a lot of confidence in Trump himself, but I have less confidence in his negotiating team on trade.
Look, Ian, I mean, anybody who lived in New York like I have for the close to the last 40 years, knew that Trump was a fraud in basically every dimension of his life, not the least of which was as a businessman, between his six bankruptcies, his nearly filing for personal bankruptcy himself, his being bailed out by his father, his being an expert at borrowing other people's money and not paying it back, and acting like it was no big deal, and acting like he was suddenly a genius for borrowing money from other people and not paying it back. It's like everything that he does, he's suddenly a genius for doing it his way, even though there's, you know, clear violations of the law, and everybody else who did it would be in jail by now. So, this is a phenomenon that I'm not quite sure I understand, and it's obviously not very healthy for America. As for his trade negotiating tactics. I mean, you know, he calls it the art of the deal. To me, it's pure buffoonery. You know, I don't think he's deliberately lying about who's paying the price for these tariffs, and it's obviously the American people, the American consumer, American farmers. Either he's being incredibly just lying about that, or he's a total moron and doesn't understand what he's even trying to accomplish. And I refuse to believe that, and much easier to believe that he's just a liar. And he clearly is. But I mean, here he set himself up in the situation by, you know, pushing for the Fed to lower short-term interest rates by 100 basis points, which is something usually that is pushed for or done when the economy is weak. Here the economy is strong. He's pushing for that because he wants to, you know, light the jet fuel on fire some more. And meanwhile, President Xi, who's the president for life, literally for the rest of his life, and can take a long-term view, realizes that, you know, if he thinks that Trump is pushing for lower interest rates because the economy is weak, that he has an advantage in the tariff negotiations. And so he calls Trump's bluff, and then, you know, the whole thing, you know, even though they're close to a deal, the whole thing falls apart because, you know, Trump takes a ridiculous negotiating position and says something stupid about interest rates, which he shouldn't be doing anyway. So, you know, it's just a self-inflicted wound. So many of these things are self-inflicted when it comes to Trump. His best thing that he's got going for him is the economy at the moment. And he's, you know, he not only doesn't talk about it as much as he's frankly entitled to, but the way he, you know, tries to jawbone the Fed, the way he refuses to allow interest rates to return to normal levels is injecting a huge amount of risk into the financial economy, and then he's now injecting huge amounts of risk into the actual economy through his trade policies. So this is what's going to bring him down, not a failure to, you know, impeach him or a willingness to impeach him in the House or the Senate. What's going to bring him down is he's going to get voted out of the ballot box on November 2020 because the economy is going to be in shambles along with everything else that he's done.
Well, what is particularly galling about it is that one of the first things that Trump did was pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was an arrangement to organize the entire Pacific and neighborhood against China, to have leverage over China, to force China to play by the rules, the very problems they're having with them because of theft of intellectual property, etc. But for whatever reason, Steve Bannon's ideology, whatever it was, or maybe it was because TPP was an Obama initiative, the first thing Trump does is cancel it. And of course, that has freed China to have their own alternative to the TPP. And you've seen ever since the TPP went down the drain, China has become more assertive. They've turned back the clock in terms of freedom and democratic change at home. And you've got, as you point out, you've got Xi there for life because it's a dictatorship. But that's, to my mind, is where this whole mess started. And as you point out, Trump seems to think that if there's a trade imbalance in China's favor or a trade deficit, then we're getting taken to the cleaners. And then he also thinks that by imposing tariffs on China, they're going to pay, when in fact it's the American corporations and the American consumers. So it's really a pretty sad record.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I mean, I've never seen somebody sort of insult us on a daily basis, regularly on a daily basis, as often as this as President Trump does. You know, you can give him, I guess, credit fairly for, you know, unleashing the animal spirits in the economy, which is probably, you know, a good thing, although, you know, it's without the proper regulation of it, you know, capitalists running wild is never a good thing, never leads to a good outcome. But, you know, it has increased the, you know, annual GDP growth rate is projected now to increase to to be at 3.2%, which is respectable. It's been better in the Obama administration, but it's respectable. It's above the sort of 2-2.5% range that we've been sort of living with. You know, he's probably reduced some of the regulations that were getting onerous, especially on small banks that, you know, had to comply with Dodd-Frank, even though it was consuming all of their profits to do so. So some of that unwinding is a good thing. But honestly, the real problem to me, and it's the same problem that we had leading up to the last financial crisis, which is, you know, I've studied extensively and written about extensively, is this, you know, manipulating interest rates by keeping them low for so long forces investors to reach for yield, higher interest-paying instruments, financial instruments, and then they end up overpaying to get that yield, paying a higher price for those securities, and then they overpay for the risk that they're taking. They don't get the return that they need for the risk that they're taking. And when companies that are issuing this debt, you know, start defaulting or coming a cropper, then billions and billions, nearly probably trillions of dollars could be lost, never to be recovered. And that, you know, when that kind of thing starts happening, then the credit markets freeze up, and then everybody loses confidence, and Wall Street and the credit markets and the financial markets are a confidence game, and once that confidence is lost, as we saw in 2007 and 2008, it's like sand being thrown into the gears. And it's quite a lot of effort to get that sand out of the gears. And instead of doing what Fed chairmen are supposed to do, which is to take the punch bowl away as the party is getting started, and I think Jerome Powell was doing that last November and December, Trump jawbones him into reversing course, not raising interest rates, and now he's talking about 100 basis points decrease in interest rates. He tried to nominate two buffoons to the Fed board. I mean, this is just one insult after another on a daily basis, and he's determined to wreck, you know, the things that are great about this country. And I can't for the life of me figure out why, because nobody has benefited more from the things that this country allows people like Donald Trump than Donald Trump. And here he is trying to wreck it for everybody.
And again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, When Lenders Push Borrowers Over the Edge. Let's talk about your op-ed, Bill, because I've often thought that you know, the modern American capitalism is kind of doomed, in the sense that so much of what Wall Street seems to be about nowadays is about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And even during the days of the robber barons, they produced stuff. They didn't make money out of money and high-speed trading and all of these gimmicks. But you're pointing out this latest alarming gimmick, which again is hurting capitalism, and that is that, you know, lenders used to lend money to companies in the hope, one, that they'd pay it back, but two, that the company would grow and succeed. But you've now got, through these credit default swaps, you've got these hedge funds exploiting that and essentially destroying really viable companies and forcing them into bankruptcy. So walk us through this, you know, I don't know whether you call it a scam or not, but it's the latest
practice.
It's
a phenomenon. I mean, it's what it is it's hedge fund managers being, you know, priding themselves on being too clever by half, taking advantage of essentially a loophole in the system that allows them legally to do what they're doing, but is completely against the interests of other creditors, the shareholders of a company, the management of a company, the employees of a company, all so that they can make as much money as they possibly can. And it's like, you know, we're in it to make as much money as we can for our investors, or for, you know, Mr. Hedge Fund Manager, and everybody else be damned. Who cares? And, you know, I don't think that's the social compact. That's not the economic compact that we signed up for. So, you know, what happens here, and I use the example of this company, Windstream, which is an emerging telecom company in Arkansas that was, you know, a fairly large company, a growing company, and this hedge fund here in New York, Aurelius Capital Management, bought about $310 million of its debt at a discount, and then argued that the company had was in technical default because it, you know, hived off a subsidiary, or it did something that it did, you know, Aurelius noticed was a technical default on some of its indentures. None of the other creditors thought it was a problem, but you know, Aurelius decided that it, they could exploit that technical default without disclosing it to any other creditors or to anybody, to the company, to the shareholders, to anybody. They had loaded up on credit default swaps, insurance that pays off when a company defaults and you own their debt. So they decided they could make much more money by forcing this company into bankruptcy and getting 100 cents on the dollar, multiples of 100 cents on the dollar, because you can buy as much insurance as you want, as much credit default swaps as you want, regardless of the how much of the underlying debt you own. And so they made a fortune by forcing this company into bankruptcy on a technical default. And it's just, you know, it's outrageous. It's not the way the system's supposed to work. It's not the compact that is entered into by companies and their creditors. It's a loophole, and it should be closed by the SEC, by the regulators. Whoever is in charge of stopping this kind of bad behavior should stop it immediately, because this is, you know, another failure of late capitalism, and it's really going to destroy the whole thing.
Well, William Cohen, thank you for your lesson on the latest chicanery on Wall Street. I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times. And his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, When Lenders Push Borrowers Over the Edge. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by